This is an ABC podcast.
What I love about the tuinga is that it's more than the tuinga. The making of it, the history and the materials that are used are tied to our material culture, our stories, our celebration, and it's usually a momentous occasion. So tuinga is everything to me.
I feel really proud when I see them and I think about their journey through time and the innovations that we've taken with them within the culture, and who would have worn them.
When you put on a headdress, a necklace or armband, it's more than body adornment. There is deep meaning. You're wearing what your ancestors have worn for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And these items form a part of specific ceremonies. I'm Natasha Metten, your new host of Sisters Let's Talk. Today I'm excited to learn about tuinga. Before we hear from two interesting and insightful Samoan women about their experiences researching and making tuinga, I should tell you a bit about myself. First, I'd like to give recognition to the original custodians of this land, the Yagara and Turrbal people, where I have worked and lived with my family for the last 4 years. Again, hello sisters. My name is Natasha Metten and I come from Papua New Guinea in a small town called Medang. I'm originally from Dagua in the East Sepik province and Manam Island. I have 6 older siblings and a surviving mom whom I love and miss. Being the last of the family has allowed me to observe how siblings naturally took on roles in the family and in customary obligations as expected by the society. My experiences of living in Papua New Guinea has shaped me to believe women need more recognition, not necessarily given to us by our men, but from within our own sisterhood or ourselves. For me, I'm passionate about being the mouthpiece for marginalized communities like us women. I've always believed that information is power, as once said by Harry S. Truman, and I believe with my work here, I hope to work alongside women experts, professionals, and from all lines of work, not forgetting women who share their experiences to provide as much information needed to incite conversations in our own households. I hope to create a safe space for all of you women to be confident in embracing the beauty of feminine power. With that being said, I'm privileged to work for Sisters Let's Talk as it provides the perfect podium for us women to share our unique stories and hopefully connect us all in realizing that we are not alone. As a woman, I am grateful to be part of this sisterhood and keep the beacon alight, as passed on by our beautiful friend, my colleague, and Susa, who I know and will miss, Hilda Wayne. Sister Hilda, thank you for setting the bar high for me and for more Pacific women in this industry. Your work has paved way for more women to take ownership of their voice and to share it with the world. Thank you, through Susa. So sisters, let's talk about tuinga. It's such a beautiful and majestic ceremonial headdress that was worn only by certain high chiefs. There has been a cultural shift with the tuinga now being repositioned as a dance-oriented adornment. But this has not changed how culturally significant it is for Samoans.
I feel that they're getting more popular because there is more appreciation of our mesina, our traditional or our cultural material culture, but also because it's something that connects you and it's important when you perform to wear a tuinga if you are a daughter or a son of a high chief or if you are a chief yourself.
Jodie Fotu Osamoa Jackson is based in Auckland, New Zealand, and she makes contemporary tuinga for all sorts of events.
You know, people have migrated. There is a growing number. There's more Samoans that live outside of Samoa than in Samoa, and they've taken their culture with them. So owning a tuinga is quite special. And it's also quite popular now for, let's say, a wedding, and the bride or groom decide to wear tuinga to perform their tawalunga or their to do a special performance or a 21st.
We'll hear more from Jodie later in the episode. I can't wait to learn about the different materials she uses to make contemporary tuwinga. But first, let's learn more about the history. Tale Tu'inu Kuafe is the Associate Curator Māori at Tanaki Peinga Hira, the Auckland War Museum in Aotearoa, New Zealand. She has been researching tuwinga as part of her PhD.
So a traditional tuwinga is a composite headdress, so that just means that it's made up of multiple parts. And when it's put together on a person's head, it almost looks like a cloud of hair that puffs out around the head. And then you usually have a structure that looks like a very large comb called a labe, which is made up of rods that extend upwards. And then you have headband as well with nautilus shell and red parrot feathers or stinger feathers that sit on top of the hair. So it's this really kind of lavish assemblage of lots of different materials, but combined together, they form a traditional tuwinga. They're assembled or put together piece by piece. So it's usually a very long process. It can sometimes be a painstaking process. But you basically start by creating what's called a bowl. A bowl is basically a pillar or a post. And what you do is you gather up all the hair of the person who's wearing it. Bear in mind as well that traditionally in pre-colonial Samoan society, it was men who had long hair and women had short hair. So what they would do is gather up the long hair of the chief who's wearing this, tie it into a really tight bun called a funga. And then what they would do is lay out a piece of siapo or tapa cloth over the funga and the head and actually fasten that to the head. And then they would gather up and fold up any of the excess, pull it up towards the top of the bun and twist it there securely. And that would be the kind of foundation of the headdress. And then basically once you have that in place, you attach all the various parts. So usually you would start by attaching the laulu or the hair bundles. After that, the lave framework, which is that central kind of structure, which sits in front of the bowl. And then you would add the balifuyono, which is the headband with nautilus shell. And then the last step would be to secure or fasten these long kind of wispy strands of red feathers called the ieula on top of the hair. So you can imagine that it takes quite a lot of time and tweaking and securing and tying. So it is a very lengthy process to put it together.
I find it very powerful that one of the main materials is hair. Why is hair so significant across so many Pacific cultures?
Human hair kind of just inherently is seen as very sacred, and this is because it's associated with the head, obviously. But in pre-colonial Samoan culture, and actually almost all Pacific cultures, the head is the most sacred part of the body. It's really closely associated with a person's mana or power or authority. And so the hair as an extension of the head becomes an extension of a person's mana as well. And so this is really significant if we think about the fact that traditional tuwinga were worn kind of exclusively by high chiefs who were already viewed as being quite sacred. And so their heads were extremely tapu or sacred.
Well, there is no way to know how many centuries have passed since the first tuwinga were worn. Tale has studied the recorded history of the hairdresses.
In a Western sense, if you go by written accounts or kind of historical records, one of the earliest mentions of tuwinga goes back to 1830 from the journals of John Williams, who was an important missionary. He actually describes all of the different parts of the tuwinga being worn together by chiefs who were about to go into battle. So that's probably one of the earliest written kind of account of a tuwinga being seen. But also we have John Steer, who's another important missionary to Samoa, and he wrote in 1843 that he had heard of Tuinga being mentioned in some very old traditions. So he actually says at that time that they were likely very ancient distinctive tokens of rank. Those were his words. So basically you have European missionaries who witnessed Tuinga being used, you know, in the very early 1800s, but who are also being informed by Samoans at that time that Tuinga are already very ancient adornments that were important symbols of chiefly rank. So what we can, I suppose, gather from that is that Tuinga had already existed within Samoan culture for generations at that point already.
While today you will sometimes see the Tuinga worn during a dance performance, historically, very few people were allowed to wear one.
They were kind of an exclusive adornment that could only be worn by these very high chiefs. So we're talking about a select kind of elite strata of Samoan society, even in pre-colonial times. And these chiefs were believed to have semi-divine descent. So they were thought to have descended from very important gods or deities in the spiritual realm. And so by value of that descent, they were seen as extremely sacred. They had a great deal of power and authority that they wielded. And so they alone were allowed to wear the Tuinga at first. And so it becomes a really personalized form of expressing your specific mana authority as a chief. And then obviously as those lines of descent filtered down, the Tuinga became a lot more standardized. And so even today, any Samoan chief is entitled to wear a Tuinga. But yes, if we think about that very ancient, you know, perhaps original purpose that they were used for, it really was to signify this very sacred power that Ali'i or sacred chiefs, high chiefs, were thought to possess.
And they were worn on the battlefield to signify strength and power.
When we think about the fact that they were worn and used on the battlefield, that in some ways explains why they were constructed and worn the way they were, because when you have multiple pieces that are, you know, tightly secured or fastened to a person's head, interwoven with the hair, that means that they're not going to move. Because practically, if you're on a battlefield, obviously it needs to be something that's not going to come off. But I suppose for chiefs who are going into battle, it's a way to kind of boast about their status and their desire to have victory over their opponents. But also historically, and a facet of Samoan warfare was actually decapitation, the cutting off of heads. And so if we think about the fact that certain chiefs were wearing Tuinga in battle, if you could claim the head of a chief and thereby remove his Tuinga, that's a very significant act of victory and also desecration for your opponents, I suppose.
It wasn't just the high-ranking chiefs allowed to wear the Tuinga.
His taupo and his manaia, so these are his chiefly daughter and chiefly son, they were also afforded the right. And so really there's this triune relationship between those three figures. They operate together. And the taupo and manaia are really an extension of the ali'i and of his authority as well. What's interesting in this case, though, is that traditionally the taupo was seen as more sacred in status compared to the manaia. And often, if we're thinking about the close familial relationship between these three, the taupo could often be the daughter of the chief, the manaia is his son, and so it's a brother-sister relationship as well. And this relates strongly to the concept of the whenua, which is a covenant between brother and sister. That's where we see women predominantly wearing tuinga. And so the taupo, she had this special status. She was often trained at a really young age as she had to take on specific tasks and duties related to the village, related to the hosting of guests. She was usually a virgin or had virginal status, and she had specific responsibilities to fulfill kind of on behalf of the ali'i or the chief. But I think what's most interesting about the taupo, especially in relation to the manaia, is that she could be titled. So she could also have her own chiefly title. The ali'i usually has his own, or always has his own chiefly title or name. But the taupo could also have a title as well. The manaia wasn't usually titled, but the taupo was. And so what we see is that the phenomenon of taupo titles actually represents this really vital feature of chiefly lineages, because these taupo titles were usually taken from the names of really important female ancestors of high rank. And it's through these female ancestors that connections to other high-ranking families could be traced. So really, we see the preservation of this knowledge within the taupo, within the title that she carries. And this is really important because it's all about kin networks. It's all about establishing connections. And this is all working towards the ultimate goal of building up your family's name, building up your own mana and authority. So when we think of the taupo wearing the tuinga, she becomes the symbolic representation of, in particular, the mana of the tamafafine name, or the female name that she carries, but also of the mamalu, or the dignity of the ali'i that she represents. And so her authority complements that of the ali'i. And so it's this really powerful expression of how these relationships work. And the tuinga features really prominently in those expressions.
What has drawn Tale to study tuinga as part of her PhD?
I really became interested seriously in looking at tuinga during my postgrad studies. I was just about to start a master's and was thinking about what subject or topic I could focus my research on. And it was actually suggested to me to think about tuinga. And it's funny, I had never really thought about it as a serious area of research before. For me, as a Samoan woman, I've seen tuinga, growing up. It's a very common image for me to see tuinga, in all kinds of contexts. But I didn't think about it in an academic sense. But I decided to do my master's on tuinga. And basically, what I found as I started to dig into it is that I didn't actually know a lot about the original kind of early pre-colonial significance associated with them. I had just thought that they were these really beautiful headdresses that were worn, during dances for important ceremonial occasions. But I really began to become kind of interested in the symbolism that was associated with it. So yeah, that's where my journey started, really.
She has unfortunately never seen her own family's tuinga, but she has seen many other ones in the museums and collections around the world. And when she is in the same room as the tuinga that's more than a century old, she can't help but think about her ancestors.
It makes me really proud to be Samoan, because I think of the workmanship and the skill that goes into making just one tuinga, especially when I look at very old tuinga. So I've done research in museums kind of throughout Europe, but especially in a lot of German museums, I've come across some amazing tuinga. But it also makes me sad in a way, because, I think about the fact that we don't often reflect on their early history, their early significance. But in general, I feel really proud when I see them. And I think about, their journey through time and the innovations that we've taken within the culture. I think about the menkid as I think about who would have worn them. I think often we tend to generalize or standardize tuinga today, but I believe in the past they were very personalized adornments. So, when I see little quirks or features that are different in a specific tuinga, I think about, who made that creative decision and why? Like, what does that represent?
As we learned earlier, tuinga has become significant in a more contemporary way. So how does Tale feel about the new traditions being formed with modern tuinga?
Personally, I love the traditional style of tuinga, but in saying that, I also have a lot of admiration for makers of contemporary tuinga today, mainly because they're actually continuing the practice of making and wearing tuinga. And that's really pertinent to me, because I know that across the Pacific, a lot of the really beautiful pre-colonial headdress forms that were made are no longer made or seen today. So I'm proud that Samoans continue to make them and to use them and actually adapt them to, our modern day life. I also love that there's this perception of tuinga being intrinsically Samoan. So it's actually come to be almost like a symbol of cultural identity, especially for a lot of Samoans living abroad and living in the diaspora. And I think that's really powerful as well.
That's Tale Tuinukuwafe from Taranaki, Paingahira, the Auckland War Museum in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Let's get back to Jodie Fotu Osamoa Jackson, who learned to make tuinga from her mother. She spoke to Hilda Wayne.
What I love about the tuinga is that it's more than the tuinga. The making of it, the history of the tuinga, and the materials that are used are tied to our material culture, our stories, our celebration, and it's usually a momentous occasion. So tuinga is everything to me. In the past, not anybody could wear it, so it was very special. Today, it has taken on a different meaning, I suppose, and it's a very visible, you know, you see a tuinga and you know it's a Samoan event and there's much to celebrate. My mother was actually the one that made tuinga. We had to make tuinga for special occasions, so I watched Mom do it and then I gradually got to do a bit more to assist her. And I think my first one where I did it from scratch was maybe when I was 17. It was not great, but it was a good start.
That's a good start.
So just learnt it. And then I've since left Samoa and I now live in New Zealand. And my mom has since passed away. So it's even more special for me.
How do you make them?
A tuinga is made of many different things. So there's like sticks, or, you know, the coconut frond, the ribs of the tuanu, that was what was traditionally used. Then there's feathers, bird feathers traditionally. And nowadays, it's very common to use other feathers to make a tuinga. There is shells, tapa cloth, siapo.
Wow.
And afa, which is sinnet, which is the husk you get from the husk of the coconut. And then the most obvious, most significant thing in a tuinga is human hair. So hair is cut and colored or bleached and then painstakingly added to a tuinga to make it the glamorous headpiece that we know it to be.
Where do you get the hair from?
So traditionally, the hair was family hair. One family, a Tifli family, would have tuinga that they pass down. So the hair belongs to the family. And then when it's lent to someone, it must be returned. I make tuinga for people and it's weak hair, for example, or I purchase hair to make one. Yeah.
What do you like about being part of the evolution of something that is so steeped in history and pretty unique and special?
What I love about it is it allows me to be creative while still staying true to the essence and the purpose of what a tuinga was made for. I like being challenged as well because sometimes it gets a bit boring making authentic traditional tuinga. When I get the chance to create one, for example, for a dance company, for a ballet dancer that's going to bounce all over the stage and it needs to be held onto his or her head and then removed within 2 minutes. I like that challenge. And then the fun side of making tuinga is for the last 20 years, creating some for when we support our rugby team, the Manu Samoa. So even when they're losing, which we are very used to, we still have our tuingas on our head and we're still celebrating.
While Jodie's tuinga has evolved from the traditional hairdresses worn by high chiefs, it's important that they still hold cultural significance.
The story is most important to me. Without it, you're essentially just making a costume. So, you know, when I'm making a tuinga for a family, I find out what their background is a lot of the time. And I also try to explain to people why having a tuinga is important, the wear and the care of it. And I also get to teach them to be real gatekeepers with their tuinga. So don't just lend it out willy-nilly. They need to really take care of it. And talking about the significance of events and why wearing a tuinga is important. So don't wear it just for show or I see a lot of people who do it for photo shoots, and that's wonderful. But I'm more interested in people understanding why these things are important and the work that went making it, the people, the practitioners that, you know, sewed things together and gathered the feathers and all that, that kind of thing. And even the idea of putting the human hair of families. And it's very significant and important that we keep that in mind, even when we are evolving and our culture is changing and adapting.
Jodi also repairs tuinga, some of which have been in families for generations.
I fixed one from a family from Sasakwala. My friend who's from that family, that it's got her grandma's hair, her great-grandma, and it's similar to our one as well from Savai. It's got my great-grandma's hair.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's why I try to teach people to be careful. You don't just lend it out because it's precious. Some of this hair is really old. And it's one of, because I'm a still island superstitious. I get a bit scared when I'm fixed to inga with real hair.
That's very true, yeah.
And I get scared when because I normally work at night. But when I'm fixing a tuinga, I just don't do it at night.
What are some of your favorite pieces that you've made?
One of my favorite pieces was the first terrible one that I made in Savai when I was a teenager. And I didn't have all the resources, and my mom was not a kind teacher, you know, not the teacher that says, oh, will you do this? It's like, you screwed that up. She was very... She wasn't the woman of many words when it came to teaching. It was the moment where I was forced to make the most of the resources that we had. And also it taught me to not to be fiapoko, like smartass, because I said to my mom, oh, I can do it. It's really easy to do. And then when I actually had to do it myself, I realized there's a process and you really need to pay attention. And you need to respect the work of others when you're putting a tuinga together. Then I love tuingas that I ask families to give me something that's important to them that I can incorporate to a tuinga. So I made one for the Yeremia family, Naula Ulu Yeremia family from Savai or from different villages in Samoa. But they have a connection to my region, Safotulafai in Savai. So when I made that, they gave me items that were of value to their family, and they had the Samoan Savai connection, Falealili, and then the South African connection on the other side. And I got to incorporate pieces of their family artifacts to that tuinga, and it makes it distinctly theirs. And so when I see pictures of that tuinga being worn by the daughters of that family, it just gives me a sense of humility and pride that I got to do that for this amazing, deserving family.
That's Jodi Fotu Osamoa Jackson speaking to Hilda Wayne in her final interview for Sisters Let's Talk, at least for now. Thank you so much to Hilda for bringing us that conversation. And thank you to our guests, Jodi and Tale. As Pacific Islanders, we value our traditions and hope they are never lost. However, traditions are also constantly evolving, and when they do, it allows new generations to connect with their culture. Sisters Let's Talk is presented by me, Natasha Methen. Our producer is Kim Lester, and Fale Angafulu Inga Stunzna is our executive producer. Sisters Let's Talk is produced on Darumbal, Yagara and Turrbal land, and we pay respects to elders past and present.